Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
My leg and my arm weren't working at all. And I couldn't help her. I knew that I was potentially going to die.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and episode 85 with Paul Pritchard. This episode is a little different and it's definitely worth listening to the intro to give you some context. Paul is a legendary British rock climber and mountaineer. He dominated the climbing scene in Britain in the 80s and 90s until Friday the 13th of February 1998 when everything changed. Paul was attempting to climb the Totem Pole, an impossibly thin freestanding spike of rock in Tasmania, when a boulder came loose and hit him in the head, almost killing him and leaving him facing the prospect of never walking or speaking again. We haven't edited this episode to alter the way Paul speaks at all, and the episode traces Paul's life from a wayward youth trying to find his path to the thriving rock and roll climbing scene of North Wales, where he found solace and purpose, to the day when everything changed. It's a story of mortality, resilience and optimism, and it's one of my favourite conversations I've had this year. Okay, over to Paul Pritchard.
So we'll kick off, shall we?
All right, go on.
It would be great if you could just start by introducing yourself. Tell me who you are, what you do, where you are right now, and I guess where you're from.
All right. Well, my name's Paul Pritchard, and I'm a Brit originally, but I've lived in Australia for 20 years, past 20 years in Tasmania, which is where I had a massive accident, and I came back after doing a year in hospital. I came back here to live, and that's how I ended up here. What was the other?
Well, where are you from originally? I think we'll come back to all of that, which I'm very intrigued by, but where you're from and what life was like when you were a kid.
Well, I'm from Bolton, just north of Manchester originally. And I mean, I grew up on the top of Wilton Quarries, like actually like, you know, we used to knock our garden wall off the top of the quarry. It was so close to the quarry, you know, and the rocks would fall down kind of 80 foot onto the tip below. And so I grew up kind of knocking around the Lancashire moors and actually climbing climbs, even though I didn't really know it at the time, but graded rock climbs when I was maybe 8 years old, soloing up kind of moderates. And generally being naughty, kind of setting fire to the moors and watching the fire engines come around and stuff like that, you know. And when I was 13, my parents got divorced. Well, I must say, we used to go to Spain for 6 months every year whilst my dad sang in nightclubs, but it was in Benidorm, and like the English hotels would get my dad singing kind of Frank Sinatra covers and Tom Jones covers, and then when I was about 13, my mother said that we should have a secondary education, and so my dad kept on going to Spain, and my mum stayed back with us, and then that caused problems with my parents, and they ended up getting divorced. I remember going off the rails a bit because I was at that kind of puberty age, and you know, just vandalizing, and I remember setting fire to a derelict hospital and getting in trouble with the police, but I turned out all right. Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack there, though. I mean, I don't want to make it too obvious, but you know, you got into rock climbing, right? And when you were, I don't know, about what, 16, 17?
Yeah, I got into rock climbing. A physics teacher called Harold Woolley. He's dead now, but he was a climber from the Rucksack Club, and he took a group of us climbing at Wilton Quarry. So I jumped at the chance more because I was going to get back to the place where I used to live, because at that time I was living in a hairdresser's with my mum, a flat above a hairdresser's. In town, you know, and so I was going, that was the reason why I started going, why I wanted to start climbing, and then I found that I was actually quite good at climbing. I was good at something for the first time in my life, really, because I was shocking academically and really bad at sports. I remember vomiting every time we went on a cross-country run. The door just opened for me when I found that I was actually really good at something for the first time in my life. And I think that I was lucky. I was really lucky to find that, because a certain number of my friends got arrested, were in prison, got, you know, one of them got killed joyriding when he wrapped a stolen car around a tree. So I really count myself really lucky that I found rock climbing.
Yeah, it's so easy, isn't it, to see how normal lads, normal people can go one way or the other based on one meeting or one decision or...
Yeah, and I remember one time going climbing in the Lake District with him on a school trip and I never looked back really, and Wilton Quarry, I don't know if you've ever been there, Matt, but it's kind of, you know, a green hole in the moors, but it's I ended up sleeping on the top of the cliff in the heather and like kind of on camping, just going camping there overnight and climbing there every day and putting up almost the hardest routes in the country really, or by the time I was 17, I was climbing E7 and that was the top grade of the day, you know. Yeah.
And so how did you get that good that fast?
I think that Bolton climbing wall had a lot to do with it, where I was going, it's demolished now, but it was a really famous climbing wall, in like a brick wall, you know, brick edges, because this is in the like early 80s, and people like Mark Leach and Mick Lover and John Hartley and John Monks and there was actually, or Jerry Peel, there was just Hank Pascal, there was some really extraordinarily good climbers all there, and so they took me under their wing really, because I was just a shoplifting terror, really. But also, I had this really kind of crazy streak in me where I didn't seem to care for my own self. So when I say E7, they weren't really that difficult. I mean, kind of 6B and 6C, but they were just really, really dangerous. Like, you know, some of them were solos, and so I think that's how I got. That's how I came to climb some of the hardest routes in the country. Really, was just because they were bold. Yeah.
And so, if I can ask, do you think that was because that was what excited you, or were you trying to prove something, or did you just not care about your own safety?
No, I wasn't trying to prove anything. And I think that my parents splitting up really affected me. And I I was lonely. And so I have been questioning this. I mean, I think it might have been a kind of bit of a cry for help. But then I got really quite comfortable on this kind of terrain, and then took that to Wales and Llanberis, you know. Yeah.
It seems like not an obvious pilgrimage, but it seems like, especially in those days, that's what people did, was they moved to North Wales if they were rock climbers. And I've never actually asked this in the podcast, but what was the scene like there then?
In Llanberis? Well, so I moved there in kind of 85, 86. And straight away, I just realised that I just found my niche and my family, really. Just all these people that were kind of in a similar boat to me, really. It was the height of Thatcher years, where there was mass unemployment, and IRA bombs going off all the time, and the whole of society seemed to be like crumbling, and I think that I like to put it like this, really, that the government seemed to have little respect for us. I mean, you know, we were living off kind of £18 a week, and on the dole, and we, I realised that I was not alone in this kind of style of climbing. There was actually like a whole host of people that were doing very dangerous climbs, and not just dangerous climbs, but just behaving in a dangerous manner. Lots of drinking and drugs and promiscuity. I mean, you know, just like kind of, so absolutely like a kind of rock, a real rock and roll lifestyle, if you like, but with the added dimension that we would go out in the daytime climbing just like incredibly dangerous climbs, kind of at Gogarth and on the slate quarries and in the mountains. Climbs that would fall down kind of not long after we climbed them, even. When I say things like this, I think you know, I don't want to, I really don't want to exaggerate, because I don't, but I know that I'm not actually exaggerating, but some people I think that maybe it's like rose-tinted spectacles or something, you know.
No, but I think that's what's so interesting about it, like, you know, Llanberis has still got a reputation for being a, you know, certain type of town, and it attracts, you know, the kind of the passionate and the dedicated climbers of Britain. But I think, you know, you were there, you've said it, I don't think you are exaggerating. It was quite, it was punk, it was rock and roll, as you say. But did it feel like a bubble? Did it feel, what I'm really interested in is, like, did it feel purposeful? Did it feel like you'd got this thing that was special and important and that it mattered?
We were one massive family that was just living out of each other's pockets, and you know, Johnny was one of the only people that, Johnny Dawes was one of the only people that had a car, and you know, he would take us. I remember once kind of driving all the way up to Stornoderdale on the Isle of Harris, from Llanberis, and then doing the first free ascent of this massive aid route of Doug Scott's called the Scoop. And, you know, that's like gone down in climbing folklore now. Stuff like that, you know. Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, I guess that all ended in Tasmania, which we'll come on to, but how did you get into the big hills and go in, well, into mountaineering?
Yeah, that's quite interesting in itself, actually. Because Joe Brown and Mo Antoine, who's, they're both dead now, aren't they? But they had this idea that they wanted to take a bunch of hotshot rock climbers to the Himalayas, and see what they could do. And so we were going to go to this mountain called Sali Sagar in India, but just before we set off, Mo was diagnosed with a brain tumor and died, and Joe didn't want to take us on his own, or I guess, you know, I was about 20, 21 or something then, and so we gave it a year, and we thought that we still needed to go for Mo. It was going to be called the Youth in Asia expedition, Euthanasia. So we ended up changing our direction to the west face of Bhagirathi 3, which is just this like monster kind of shale-capped face, but it had no climbs on it at that time. We went there with Joe Simpson and Bob Drury, and anyway, it was a total write-off. I remember getting to the foot of the face, and then a piece of shale broke off from 900 meters above me, and hit my arm, and it didn't break my arm, but my arm was black. And so that was the end of the expedition. Like, we didn't even get on the rock. But I just, you know, just the landscape, the massive, massive landscape. It struck something in me, and well, 6 months later, I was in Patagonia with Simon Yates and Noel Crane and Sean Smith, and we did this massive climb up the Central Terra Piney, and that was it. Then I was just, for 15 years, I think I just kind of never looked back. Yeah. Well, no. What am I talking about? Actually, for 8 years, I never looked back, and then I got made disabled by a rock. But yeah.
So yeah, let's come on. I mean, there's a whole different conversation about the mountaineering years, but then there's, you know, there's books people can read, so we'll leave them something to read about. But what happened on the totem pole? I know you've told the story many times, but please, can you tell it to me?
All right. Well, I guess I'll start at the beginning where I wrote this book Deep Play in 1997, and it won the Boardman Tasker. And I used that prize money to go on a round the world trip with my then partner Celia Bull, and we found ourselves eventually at the totem pole, where we were trying to make the second free ascent of the totem pole in 1998. I think it got its first free ascent in 1995 by Steve Monks. And when we got out there, there's a rope going to the top of the totem pole from the mainland, and so we thought that rather than go down a hideously loose mainland, we would do a quick Tyrolean to the top of the pole and then abseil down it. And it's amazing, the totem pole. It's 65 meters high and only 4 meters wide. It's actually so slender that it sways slightly when you're on top of it. So I abseil all the way down to the bottom. And I'm there stood on this like one rock in the middle of the sea, because it's like sticks straight out of the sea. But then suddenly I'm like up to my chest in water, and it's like this wave hit me, and so I realized that there's no way that I was going to be able to we're in no way are we going to be able to do the to climb up to do the first pitch. Nowadays you can hang, there's a hanging belay above the water, but there wasn't back then. So I asked Celia to come down to the halfway ledge. It's split into two pitches. And so she comes down, ties the rope off, and then I swing around the kind of arete of the pole, and with my Jumar clamps on, and as I was doing that, I didn't hear anything, I didn't see anything. The next thing I knew, I was upside down, blood pouring out my head. I remember looking up at the sea, and seeing all my blood dripping pouring into the sea, Then I went unconscious a little bit, and then Celia was there by me. She'd roped down to me, got me upright in slings, put her helmet on my head. I wasn't wearing a helmet. Then she went back up to the ledge and she had to haul me 30 metres up to this ledge. It was just me and her down there. It was obviously in the day before mobile phones. So by the time she got me there, 3 hours later, her hands were bleeding and she was just... I remember her screaming at me, you know, just as I'm clambering onto the ledge, "You're going to have to help me here if we're going to get you out of this." And that's the first time that I realised then that my leg and my arm weren't working at all. I couldn't help her. And eventually she got me onto the ledge. Then she had to make me safe and go and get help. And so that involved kind of climbing back up the totem pole. There's a rope in situ left that she left there. And go back across the Tyrolean and then run 7 kilometres for help. And then 10 hours later, basically, after the rock had fallen on my head anyway, I was rescued. Paramedic came down to me, clipped me to his harness, lowered me down, like we both abseiled down to a waiting, what in Australia they called tinnies, like just an aluminium motorboat, which was acting as a lifeboat. But that was going up and down on the swell by 6 whole feet. And so on the upsurge, Neil, he's called, Neil Smith was my paramedic, who I still climb with. He cut the rope on the upsurge and we both fell into the boat. Yeah, it was very, very exciting. Yeah, and then to a waiting helicopter on the beach. Then that's when I began my year in hospital. Yeah.
And before we go into the year in hospital, can you remember all of that, or is that story from what people have told you what happened after you were hit?
I can remember quite large chunks of it. So I can remember being dragged up the wall by Celia. I can remember feeling under my helmet that Celia had put on me and realizing, you know, just like feeling that the hole in my skull and taking my hands away from it. And just covered in blood, and so I realized then that I'd done something like really, really badly to myself. And I can remember falling into the boat. I can remember kind of really fighting to stay awake, thinking that if I did go to sleep, you know, it might be the last sleep that I ever made. So really fighting to stay awake. But, you know, I would go to sleep, I'm sure, for like 2 hours at a time and then wake up again. But yeah.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, I'm really, I'm just curious as to what you were thinking about and whether or not you realised it was as bad as it was or it wasn't as bad as it was. I mean, did you feel like that was it? It was game over.
I knew that I was potentially going to die. And this is where this is really what The Mountain Path, my new book, is about. Really, it's to do with just. Because you know, I'm not a show off, but I do think that I'm a bloody resilient person, and I think I realized that the mountains that I climbed taught me how to be resilient, not in any kind of like just by osmosis almost. And so you know, I had two previous accidents. One of them where I actually drowned on Gogarth, and actually my partner Glenn couldn't find a pulse and couldn't find a breath. And again, that's a long story, but basically I realized that these experiences just taught me how to survive. Another one was I fell 55 meters off Craig Meggie ice climbing up on Centre Post Direct, and broke my back and fractured my skull again, and so I have had a lot of pain in my life, but I realized that just taught me how to go, almost like I went into this kind of meditative trance state where I'm just sure that's why I survived. You know, I lost half my blood. The brain injury that I received was really quite shocking, you know, but also I think that is why I've done like really well after like these intervening 23 years as well, because not all people that I've met in the rehab center have fared so well as me, but I must say that I think I was very lucky where the rock hit me. It hit me on the left hemisphere of the brain. So I've basically got, you know, left hemisphere brain damage with some frontal lobe taken in. But that means that the right hemisphere is the big picture stuff, and the left hemisphere is the kind of targeted kind of, if you imagine a bird of prey when it's hunting and it's got to have these pinpoint detection for spotting a mouse on the floor. But it's also got to, when it's feeding on that mouse, it's got to be aware of its surroundings, or else it can be prey for another bigger a cat or something. And so that's the right hemisphere of the brain at work there. And so I see the bigger picture, and I'm a really optimistic person. And some people who experience brain injury are really quite damaged, you know. Yeah. So I realise how lucky I am.
And how was that year?
Well, it was the same year that Princess Di died. And I remember hearing that Princess Di had died and just breaking down into absolute hysterical laughter. And because I was emotionally labile, so I would laugh at like really quite sad or, you know, sad things, and I would cry at really joyful things, and I'm still a bit like that. But so I also remember when Celia broke up with me about 5 or 6 months into my stay in hospital, that she saw me travelling back in the car, and I just laughed hysterically at her, and she was appalled, you know. But there's nothing I can do about that. I'm sorry, Celia.
Yeah, but well, it sounds like it wasn't exactly your fault, the hysterical laughter or the profound sadness.
No, it's not. And in some ways, I still maintain that brain injuries are really, really crazy things, right? But they actually, quite a lot of people are scared of brain injuries and, you know, brain injured people, because they do hold up some kind of mirror to society almost. Kind of, you know, quite a lot of people deep down actually do feel like giving up the kind of act that they're supposed to. You know, everybody's kind of acting. And so playing a role that you're supposed to play in a certain situation. And I think that liability is which is kind of showing the not normative emotional response is actually sometimes quite profound.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah. That's very, I mean, that's super interesting, because you talk about how the mountains made you resilient, and obviously those experiences carved the person that you became. And then obviously, you know, the physical ramifications of the injury were, is it your right side is paralyzed?
Yeah.
But as well as the physical side of things, I guess what I'm getting at is there's all the negative things that happened to you and the negative consequences, but also what did that brain injury and that experience create in you and teach you, and how did it change you for the better or the worse?
Well, it's, as I say, it's just, I think so differently now. And it's wholly, wholly better. Even though I'm disabled and you know, I even undergo quite a lot of discrimination in public, and including disability hate crime, so getting beaten up a couple of times. But all that, I just look at it all as lessons, and it just makes me every instance of every moment is just kind of there to teach you something, I think, including that extreme discrimination and violence.
But where does that, I mean, sorry to go into it, I just, that's shot amazing in a bad way. What, why are people discriminating against you and beating you up?
Well, if you talk to anybody with a disability, you'll realize that it's not unusual. And it's, I have looked into it, obviously, and there's a few reasons, and one of them is that they think that you're taking stuff that's, like, in terms of benefits from the government, you're taking things that are not rightly yours. So it's a whole raft of things. One of them is, that they think that they're actually doing society a favour by hitting you or just discriminating against you in Australia, I'm not sure what the unemployment rate is like for disabled people in Britain, but in Australia it's 57%, I think. So it's like, it's actually not many disabled people have jobs.
It's one of those societal problems that we kind of have forgotten to look at, I think. We just sort of see those people as being there.
Yeah, but you know what? I think that we've had marriage equality, we've had civil rights, we've had gender equality. I think that it's a really exciting time to be a cripple now. Because it is actually our time, you know. Yeah. And so,
I mean, I sense you're saying that with a smile on your face, almost like you know that it's a funny thing to say, but you mean it, don't you? It's sincere.
No, it's totally sincere. I think that the gains that disabled, that people with disabilities are making now, because I think that disability, like, anyone can become disabled, and so it's not the same as you know, not nobody can change the race or the sexuality, but it goes right to the heart of being human, disability really. And so I think that this is our time.
And normally when I ask this next sort of question, I feel like I know the answer, but I'm just guiding someone. I actually don't know what you're going to say to this, but if you could go back and change it, would you?
Go back and change my accident? No, not at all. Not at all. And you know what? I know quite a lot of people with disabilities now. And you know, I do this thing called Project Able, where all these people with disabilities kind of go around to schools I'm also in the Human Library, and so which is going around to workplaces and schools and telling your story. And anyway, I've never met a single person who would have it any other way than what they are now. Because it's basically negating what you are, isn't it? And so, I think if you did wish that, if you did wish that, you would be quite a depressed person because you'd never be able to have it.
And how important has it become to you to be part of a community of people with disabilities? You know, it's not, you know, you say you know lots of people with disabilities. I don't. And I think that's, you know, I haven't sought them out. Have you sought them out, or it?
Yeah. Well. So those two projects that I just talked about. I mean, they're the kind of work that you can get as a person with a disability. So it's not. So. You know, I still hang out with climbers and stuff, but at the same time, I just found myself kind of in the mix, as it were, with people with disabilities. And I'll tell you what, they're some of the strongest and most resilient people that I've ever met, because they have had to deal with some shit in their lives, you know. Yeah,
and really interestingly, I think you just said I still hang out with climbers, but I mean, you are a climber, right? That firstly, that never left you, as in no. You know that you are the person that you always were then, but also you still climb, don't you?
I'm still leading the life of a climber. Because I think that the lessons that I learned in the mountains are still put to use every day of my life. So I don't go climbing that often because it's actually quite painful for me. I dragging my half a body up the rock, you know. I much prefer cycling on my tricycle for my exercise. Which when I say exercise, I mean I've been going on kind of trike expeditions where I would go, you know, across Tibet or from the lowest point to the highest point of Australia and stuff like that. And that's really quite, it's a lot less painful for me. So, yeah.
And why are those experiences important to you? Why do you need them?
That's a good question, isn't it? I mean, I think that I do it for the challenge, and that's maybe quite a trite thing to say at first glance, but that challenge has this kind of questioning at its heart, you know, and that this challenging questioning, if we do it often enough, it's like mind training almost, and it teaches us how to be more accepting and in the face of kind of, you know, inevitable experiences, like negative experiences that we're all going to face one day if we're not already facing them now. And so that's why I do it. That's why I really, I'm not explaining myself very well, but I think it is for the challenge.
No, and it's like you said before we press record, like, you've just written a book about this, right? You know, that's it. You've spent the time and the hours writing the philosophy.
I'll send you a book because I reckon that you'd really like it.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. I'm sure I will.
As we draw this to a close, like, I'm intrigued by the writing process. You know, you were writing before your accident and you've written since. How different is writing for you now? And does it serve a purpose outside of just telling a story?
I didn't think it did, but this latest book, I mean, it took me 6 years to write it, right? And it's a real process. And I had to think about every word. I mean, it's actually, I think I type with one finger, but I think at half the speed that I did before. And so I think that slowness actually is really good. It helps me. But it also means that I type at the same speed as I think. So you know, I could spend like an hour writing one killer sentence. I did have something else to add to that, but I've forgotten what it was now. Yeah.
Well, don't worry. Just before we do end, one thing that's kind of like shocked me when I thought about it for the first time when I was doing the research was, you had the accident in, what was it, February 98? And yes. But then the Totem Pole book won the grand prize at Banff the next year. So,
yeah.
But you suffered a horrendous life-changing brain injury.
Yeah.
And did you write the book in hospital?
That whole book was written in hospital. Yeah. With one finger, yeah, yeah. It's
but a, how?
And it was in the early days of laptops. I remember that it was like 1998. There was my good friend lent me this like the first laptop, and it was like, and I just sat in my ward. There was like six beds to a ward, and I would just write. It was either that or go down to the day room with the other clients, I guess and watch reruns of The Bold and the Beautiful or something, you know. I mean, there's nothing wrong with watching The Bold and the Beautiful, but it was not for me. So I think that goes back to what I was saying about the part of my brain that was damaged. Just was, I still had all my intellect, you know, and not, I think you'd call it, well, and even though I was half the speed that I was, and that's, I still knew how to form a sentence. And also the fact that I'd won the Boardman Tasker for Deep Play in 1997 meant that, you know, I sold all my climbing gear. I had this big room full of climbing gear and expedition gear, like many climbers do, and I sold it all. I remember crying when somebody came to buy my skis and ski boots, because I thought that I would never go climbing again, and so I thought, well, what can I do? And obviously, I just had this incredible accident with incredibly Bold rescue on this, on like the most sexy piece of rock in the world, and so Ken Wilson encouraged me to write about it. Yeah. So that's how it came about.
Lucky us. So I always end this with two questions, and you can interpret them however you like.
Okay.
What scares you?
I don't get scared. I think that's part of my problem. I don't think. I think that it's probably is a problem with my brain, but I actually don't get scared. And
you're the first person who's ever said that.
I think maybe what I'd get very, very upset and sad, and, you know, if anything happened to my kids. But I would see it. I'd still be able to kind of see it as a lesson.
What brings you hope?
And I said that I'm an incredible optimist. Because of my brain injury, and so I just see hope everywhere, all the time. Like, you know, this stuff at Glasgow, just the the COP 26, like I'm actually super optimistic about anything like that. That doesn't mean that we don't have to work towards solving all this stuff, and that doesn't mean that we don't have to work towards educating people, you know, bullies who bash disabled people. You know, like I think everything's got to be worked at, but if you accept I just think that if you accept everything that befalls you, it still leaves hope for change, and so it's not resignation. And so by radically accepting everything, the good and the bad, you don't really need hope.
That's amazing. That's right. Well, we'll leave it there. That was brilliant. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, good chatting with you, Matt.
Thanks for listening. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft, is a Cold House production, and is produced and put together by Ola Omori and Alex Hall. If you'd like to keep in touch, you can email us at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk, and you can stay in touch on Instagram @theadventurepodcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.